rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Cholley. It's Wednesday, so that can only mean one thing. It's PMQ's Unpacked. Patrick McGuire and I pause the action as Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer go at it across the dispatch box. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel. And a Wednesday means it's Crampon. It's Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson. Let's talk about Christmas.
Yeah.
And the politics of Christmas, it all comes around. It comes around earlier and earlier every year. Jenny Harris, who the government put in charge of the UK Health Security Agency, but then seemed to go out of their way to constantly distance themselves from anything she says. She says we should try and limit our socialising this Christmas. The government says no, have your Christmas party, but be cautious. And I'm not sure what that means, Robert.
I feel a bit sorry for Jenny Harris. I mean, she's the chief executive of the UK Health Security Agency, and it kind of clues in the name, really. She's doing her job and saying, well, you know, if health security is all you're concerned about, and that is what she is concerned about, then don't go to a party. And then I guess Boris Johnson is doing his job and trying to be boosterish and saying, no, let's all go out and have a good time. And then they just, you know, criticise Jenny Harris for doing her job. It doesn't help that she doesn't particularly look like she enjoys a party. Whereas, do you know what I mean? She's very much kind of kid at the front of the class, and Boris is the good time guy at the back of the class, isn't he? And it's a sort of a lot of coronavirus disagreements that sort of fall within that kind of rubric, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, I feel a bit sorry for her. I think she's just saying what is a sensible thing for someone in her position to say and getting criticised for it.
But I suppose, Alice, there's a point at which maybe politicians are slightly more in the real world than the health professionals. And it's one thing saying, yes, don't go to your parties, stay indoors forever. Like, that's the perfect way to get control of the virus, but that's not going to happen. So is it actually better to have, like Sajid Javid saying, take a lateral flow before you go to your Christmas party, acknowledging that some people are going to go to their Christmas party? So in the real world, saying, look, of course you're going to go to your Christmas party if you're having one, but take a lateral flow before you go, that seems like a more logical real-world solution to the issue.
Yes, Sajid Javid, I always think, is the sort of ultimate dad, isn't he? That, you know, with his children, it's sort of like, be cautious, be sensible, be pragmatic, take the middle line. And actually, maybe as sort of centrist dad, he's the one that's doing what most of us will probably end up saying to our children or when we do. And also, as Robert said, it depends whether you like dancing at parties. I've got a kind of weird obsession about what Boris Johnson's Christmas must be like, because he is so utterly transfixed on that one date. Yes. That you kind of think that, you know, he's got that farm in Exmoor, whether all the Johnsons come together and just have such an incredible time that they can't face ever missing it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that everybody else is as obsessed about Christmas as the government. I mean, we like it, but we'd rather get rid of this pandemic.
Although Hugo Rifkin wrote a column yesterday talking about, he basically said that we were obsessed with Christmas and he could completely understand why it was such a political. I mean, I also think maybe those of us with smaller families who normally have a smaller Christmas, this all, you know, all seems, but maybe Boris Johnson's particular family situation means that Christmas is a slightly more complicated, numerous affair. Should we put it like that?
Blended, I think, is what you're meant to call it, aren't you?
But yeah, I thought Hugo's column was really interesting on just how obsessed we are with Christmas as a date in the diary, which is essentially for most, you know, millions and millions of people who never go to church. It's not a Christian thing, but there is something sort of.
You could almost say Christmas was a national religion, and then you realise, oh.
Oh, it is, yes, though, but you know, Christmas is a brand, a brand alongside like the NHS or whatever. It's it's very important.
And the
people.
Second World War. That's the big trio, isn't it, that we worship at?
Yeah, or the First World War when we all had that ceasefire for Christmas, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yes,
that
exactly.
Kind of combines
that
was, the whole
thing. Yes, all done, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah,
it's all interwoven. You know, you can go all the way back to Oliver Cromwell if you want to. That's, you know, for everything that Oliver Cromwell did, what was really bad was he banned Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why he's not a national hero.
He is to me.
Do you think there's also a little bit, Robert, of the government sort of talks itself into these messes by constantly talking about Christmas? They then get themselves into the situation that they're then the Grinches.
Well, it does have a horribly ominous, familiar look, doesn't it? I think pretty much the same thing happened last year. I mean, it's almost identical, isn't it? Maybe they might have been wiser to not to talk about Christmas until, you know,
Christmas,
yeah, Advent, whenever that is. Oh, we're in Advent.
We're
now,
in
aren't
Advent.
We?
That was on Sunday. We've been told that goes from the Sunday.
Oh, I thought it started on the first.
No, I think it goes from. Sunday.
I thought it started on the first, because
that's when you start opening.
No, I think Asmira. There's a whole issue about this, but I think it actually starts on the Advent Sunday.
I see.
Yeah, no, in fact, I was looking in my diary, my hard, you know, printed book diary, and yeah, it said on Sunday, first day of Advent, which I didn't know. That's getting earlier and earlier.
Yeah, and the children are going to feel cheated because they got their chocolates only in their calendars only run from today.
Talking of things which come around again and again and again, Priti Patel's plans to get a grip on the migrant crisis. I've reported in the Times today that she's embarking on a grand tour of Europe.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't invited to the talks in France, so she's going to have her own. She's off to Rome, Belgium and Berlin, we think. She's also talking about, I'm not quite sure how this works, she wants to... Because earlier in the week, Sajid Javid convened a meeting of the G7 health ministers to talk about Omicron and the spread of the pandemic around the world, which maybe makes sense. Priti Patel wants to organise a meeting of G7 interior ministers, which basically means Canada, Japan and America have to agree to join the Zoom in order to get Germany, France and Italy to come on board. What do we think? Is this going to work, Alice?
Well, I think Priti Patel's problem is that she has just plummeted in the polls for among Tories. She's now, you know, as bad as Boris Johnson and the Chief
Whip.
And I think she looks at Liz Truss, who is going around the world and doing rather better, and everyone seems to rather love, and is at the top of the list. Yeah. And they've always been very competitive anyway. And I think she thinks, well, maybe if she's going around the world, I can too. And
but now it's all going to be
a bit
on
of
Zoom
action.
Anyway.
But actually, if it's all on Zoom, then that's a disaster. So I think, I don't think this is going to help the migrant crisis at all, having her, you know, jumping on and off planes or in Zooms. I think actually what they've got to do is they've got to focus on the French now. I mean, that's our main issue. And actually the French aren't going to be any happier if we try and bring other people in on our side.
Although the French did say that they wanted an EU solution, didn't they? They said that at the weekend, I think, because they didn't want to try and do any more bilateral deals with the Brits. They wanted to... it had to be an EU solution, and I think... I feel a tiny bit sorry for Priti Patel. I didn't think I'd ever hear myself saying that.
What?
I know, but...
Clip that up for the Christmas special.
She, she's got her own officials briefing against her, calling her a headless chicken. But she's got to try and do something about this. And
do you think they're bullying her now?
Maybe she's being bullied. I'm not sure I feel that sorry for her. But in saying, I'm going to have a meeting with my counterparts in Rome and Brussels and Berlin... That doesn't make her a headless chicken. That just means she's trying to do her job, doesn't it? Because we know that the migrant crisis extends beyond France. We know that the whole network of smuggling gangs goes all across Europe, and the supply chain of the boats and so on. So I think she's being I'm not sure. I'm not saying anything will come of it, but I think she's being slightly unfairly maligned.
Well, I suppose I think the headless chickenism was basically get me on a plane to somewhere. It just turns out that Italy were the people who said,
yeah,
okay, fine.
Well, if that's the way it went down, then I suppose that's being critical. But maybe she was just saying, I don't know, trying to. We've got to do something, haven't we? And it's not going very, getting very far with the French.
It's extraordinary, extraordinary. But let's just sit and ponder there in defence of Priti Patel from Robert Crampton. I'm sure the comment desk will take 1,000 words on that. Alice, let's talk about your column today. On in fact, because we talked about this Pew, I love this research from Pew Research Centre in America about what life is all about, and you've written about hobbyists because Brits are more prone to putting hobbies in the top three than anyone else.
Yeah, so the Brits put family, friends and hobbies in their top three, and everyone else in the world tends to put, well, some put society, which is really low down in Britain, but most of them put occupation and material well-being and occasionally health. Yeah. And it just fascinates me that the British are so obsessed by hobbies. So I did some research on hobbies, and it is true. I mean, we not only invented the word, but we were ridiculed for it in the 17th, 18th, 19th century. And then George Orwell sort of made it acceptable because he then wrote about it. And what's fascinating is a lot of the continentals always think of us as a very class-ridden society, but hobbies is the one thing that links us all. So every class in Britain had a hobby. They all had, that was sort of something that came out in the Victorian era. They were all totally obsessed by hobbies. And they're meant to be completely pointless, most hobbies, really. Mm. It's just a way of being what we'd now call mindfulness, of just total absorption in something that you absolutely love doing that is not really necessary for anything or a job or you're going to win a gold medal.
And it's interesting that we don't put society up there, but in a way, hobbies are our version of society, aren't they? I mean, it's the way we interact with other people. I mean, although a lot of hobbies are actually fairly isolated, a lot aren't. And it's
The internet's quite good in a way. You think that it's ruined hobbies, but on the other hand, it brings together all these hobbyists. So then you do find out they're still train spotters, or you discover that people are still obsessed by butterflies. It's kind of continued now. There was a sort of blip in the 1980s when everyone was incredibly down on hobbies and it was all about work, and everyone was seen as slightly, if you wanted a stamp collection, you were considered slightly sort of pathetic.
Yeah.
Whereas now I think people just look at it and think, well, actually, this is a way through the pandemic. It's also kind of a way of relaxing without costing vast amounts of money.
Yeah, and people have embraced it as a sort of great British eccentricity, I think. And it's kind of fashionable now in a way.
Do you have hobbies?
Yeah, I've got hobbies, I'm more like obsessions, really. Quizzes are my hobby. Obsession, online quizzes. I wrote about that. Got my upcoming column is about that very subject.
Well, I'm now stalking Robert so much that I actually looked up hobbies and him. And he did write one a few years ago when he didn't have any hobbies. And then they've slowly increased.
He is
now the ultimate hobbyist.
Yeah. And table tennis, a bit of gardening. I mean, the classic ones, actually, really. Walking, reading, gardening. Absolute middle-class, classic middle-class hobbies. Never model railways or anything. Not that sort of those usual sort of boy kind of Oscar electrics. I haven't got the deck.
Catelyn Moran wrote a piece on it, and she was saying that it's sort of all the women do, hobbies that are actually knitting or crocheting or something to do with the home, and it's actually there is a point to them. But in fact, I think that's all changed now, and that men were meant to do things like golf, which were completely useless. Yeah. I think now everyone just has a sort of mix of. I've seen loads of men knitting.
Sure.
I think everyone has a mix of hobbies now. It doesn't really matter.
Tom Daly.
I mean, the Queen is the ultimate one, isn't she? I mean, she has so many hobbies, the Queen. I'm always fascinated because she was working full time still in her 90s. But
I was going to say but it helps if you haven't really got a day job. But if your whole life is a hobby, going around looking at nice things and chatting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I also think it may help.
Are you based here?
Or the fact that she didn't go to school, don't you think? That she just did loads of things when she was kind of younger. Because at school, hobbies aren't really what you end up doing, do you? Do maths and English. I'd spend my whole time in train sets.
And a lot of us would actually probably, we'd prefer to be spending our lives doing our hobby, wouldn't we?
But talking about the society thing, I remember thinking that David Cameron got the big society all wrong. In that he was sort of pitching it as, everyone should become a magistrate.
Yeah.
And what they completely missed was the big society is people who run football teams for teenagers or run organised scouts and all that sort of thing. And I suppose that's sort of volunteering, but that's essentially a sort of hobby. It's a thing that you like to do that you don't need to do, which you can get completely absorbed in and you don't get paid for. And I just sort of felt he got all that wrong, that there's a whole sort of network of people who do things just for the fun of it.
I mean, I was at a nature reserve yesterday doing a piece for our charity Appeal. And it was absolutely chock full of middle-aged and elderly people bird watching. I mean, huge numbers of people, and you know, and all talking to each other and interacting, and like, you know, what we would call community or what we would call mindfulness. And we've kind of always done that, and we're just, I think we're probably turning up, you know, getting back to knowing that it's realizing its importance is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
All those cyclists we have around us, and there are loads of cyclists now, and actually, you know, that there's absolutely pointless because they're just cycling around and around the road.
Well, middle-aged men have given up golf and replaced it with cycling, haven't they?
With just as much kit.
Yes, with just as much kit. And but maybe it's...
and slightly tighter trousers.
Slightly tighter trousers, yeah.
But I think, you know, lockdown, the past 18 months have definitely had it. We like, in the depths of the first lockdown, we've sat at the kitchen table and we all, like, made papier-mâché balloon animals. Yeah. It was brilliant. Robert Crumpton and Alice Thompson there. And, of course, you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is PMQ's Unpacked.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
How
would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast now. It's time for this.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and Patrick Maguire.
It's that time of the week when we go live to the House of Commons to pause the action and explain what is going on between Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. I'm joined this week by Patrick Maguire, Times Red Box editor. Patrick, how are you doing?
I'm very well. It's good to be back in your big chair in the studio, Matt.
You're in the big chair in the studio. I'm in the big chair at home, but that's fine. We can still watch along and enjoy it together. We should just say, Patrick, before we go to PMQs, your Red Box email's had a bit of a makeover.
It has. It is, and it looks beautiful. I recommend everyone goes to the times.co.uk/redbox to get an altogether more elegant read than ever before. In your
elegant,
inbox.
Elegance.
Every day.
Elegance is definitely the word that I would use. It's very special.
Unlike its ungainly author, of course, but you can't have everything.
Yeah, if you want to get Patrick in your inbox every morning, you can sign up at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. Right, Patrick, what do you think is going to come up at PMQs today? Obviously, it's been a big week for Keir Starmer, shaking up his front bench team. Will this herald a new punchier Keir Starmer at the dispatch box, do you think?
I would be very surprised if Keir Starmer didn't pick up the gauntlet that Yvette Cooper and Wes Streeting, his new Shadow Home Secretary and Shadow Health Secretary, laid down to the government yesterday, which was a demand for those pre-departure tests, a more beefed-up COVID border regime. Obviously, in the last 20 minutes, we've had the leak of Sage papers talking about how valuable those pre-departure COVID tests would be for catching the variant and criticising the government's current day two testing regime. So I'd be very, very surprised if Keir Starmer didn't go hard on that. And interestingly, I picked up on this morning's Red Box email. Labour's rhetoric on Christmas is markedly different to what their rhetoric around Freedom Day in July was, right? At that point, they were sort of half-heartedly saying you should extend restrictions. Now they're saying the public deserves a great Christmas, having endured so much hardship and misery over the past 18 months, and it's now on you. So it'd be interesting to see whether Keir Starmer can, you know, channel his, you know, personality, shall we say, into that party-loving line.
Well, there we are. Can Keir Starmer rebrand himself as a party animal? Let's find out as we go live to the House of Commons. It's question number one from Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I join the Prime Minister in his words on disability and the victims of extreme weather?
Can I also mark World AIDS Day? Extraordinary advances mean people living with HIV on effective treatment can now enjoy normal life expectancy and are no longer at risk of passing on the virus. It's within our hands to end new transmissions in the UK this decade. We must do so, Mr. Speaker. As millions of people were locked down last year, was a Christmas party thrown in Downing Street for dozens of people on December the 18th?
Mr. Speaker, what I can tell the Right Honourable Gentleman is that all guidance was followed completely during Number 10. And can I recommend to the Right Honourable Gentleman that he does the same with his own Christmas party, which he's advertised for December the 15th, to which unaccountably he's failed to invite the Deputy Leader, Mr. Speaker.
So we should explain, Patrick, this is a story on the front page of the Daily Mirror today. I was a bit confused by it because it took me a bit of unpacking that it actually referred to a Christmas party held 12 months ago.
Yeah.
With a leaving do for a senior ally and a Christmas party, which actually, I mean, at what point does a group of people standing in a room listening to a leaving speech turn into a party?
Yes, and that's the Downing Street line. All rules were abided by at all times, which isn't a denial of the substance of the Daily Mirror story that 40 to 50 people piled into one of those pokey rooms in Downing Street, you know, in inverted commas, cheek by jowl. But as you say, there is probably a degree of ambiguity in the rules there. What's interesting about that line of attack from Keir Starmer, and it'd be interesting to see where this line of questioning ends up, I suspect we might hear more about sleaze, is that it picks up that familiar theme that Keir Starmer has prosecuted with varying degrees of success, the one rule for them, one rule for the other. And he's hitherto struggled to turn that into a compelling story about the government's competence or lack thereof. But let's see whether he can.
Is it really true, Patrick, that Keir Starmer is having a Christmas party to which Angela Rayner is not invited?
Well, I mean, every single member, lest I, you know, invite listeners into the sausage machine, that is Westminster journalism, every single member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery is invited to this party on the 15th of December in the Labour leader's office. Warm white wine with Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. Angela Rayner's name was not mentioned on the invitation, but it should be said that, you know, in the old days, the deputy leader has always hosted their own Christmas drinks. But, you know, given that, you know, after the botched reshuffle in May, Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner made a point of effectively, you know, skipping arm in arm through Portcullis House, you think the most effective way to dampen stories about divisions would be by having a joint knees up. Perhaps Angela didn't respond to the invitation.
I must have a look through my emails. I'm sure my invite is there somewhere. Right, let's go back then. This is question number two from Keir Starmer.
Keir Starmer!
Nice try, but that won't work. Mr. Speaker, the defence seems to be no rules were broken. Well, I've got the rules that were in place at the time Prime Minister of this party. They're very clear, Mr. Speaker. You must not have a work Christmas lunch or party. Does the Prime Minister really expect the country to believe that while people were banned from seeing their loved ones at Christmas last year, it was fine for him and his friends to throw a boozy party in Downing Street?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've said what I've said about Number 10 and the events of 12 months ago, but he's since asked about what we're asking the country to do this year, Mr. Speaker, which I think is, frankly, a more relevant consideration. The important thing to do, Mr. Speaker, is not only to follow the guidance which we have set out, but also when it comes to dealing with the Omicron variant, to make sure that, as we've said, that you wear a mask on public transport and in shops, Mr. Speaker, and that you self-isolate if you come into contact with somebody who has Omicron, Mr. Speaker. And above all, what we're doing is strengthening our measures at the borders, but particularly, and I think this would be very valuable for everybody here, get your booster, Mr. Speaker. I know the Right Honourable Gentleman is eligible for his booster. I'm not going to ask him, Mr. Speaker, since I'm forbidden to ask him questions, but I hope very much that he's had it.
Well, I can tell the Prime Minister I've had mine. Keir Starmer.
Lindsay Hoyle there, never missing a chance to stick his all in. We should point out, actually, looking at the front bench, even Jacob Rees-Mogg has a mask on today, which has not been the case in previous weeks, Patrick McGrath. And Rachel Reeves is wearing a very heavy-duty sort of industrial mask. There's been lots of discussion about the merits of cloth masks versus sort of medical ones. So the mask mandate seems to be working in the House of Commons. If you can get Jacob Rees-Mogg to wear a mask, then the promise is doing something right. Do you think this is going to land, this trying to go back to something that happened at a Christmas party a year ago, Patrick McGuire, when most people are thinking about their Christmas parties this year?
I mean, it's not Bernard Castle, is it? Would be my one sentence assessment of the viability of this attack. Obviously, it's all grist to the mill in terms of the attack Keir Starmer wants to cut through in terms of the broader message he's trying to get across the electorate. But I don't think this is going to set many pulses racing down at the... Actually, I was going to say down at the Pineapple in Kentish Town. They'll love this, the Pineapple in Kentish Town, Keir Starmer's local. But, you know, in the Dog and Duck in Uxbridge, in outer London, I can't imagine many people will do anything but shrug at this, to be frank.
And actually, the thing that's come up, particularly in all the focus groups we've done for the last 18 months on Times Radio, is that Keir Starmer's reputation is for harking back to old stuff, you know, Mr. Hindsight, and try to turn the clock back and pick fault. I mean, this is like the worst possible example of that. But maybe, you know, maybe it's all part of that, you know, one rule for them, one rule for everyone else.
Attack. It certainly is. And, you know, come the inquiry, I'm sure... The stories like this, and the Matt Hancock story, his philandering in the Department for Health while other people were banned from hugging their relatives is of a piece with this. But you know, the merits of the story and the truth of the story, as we've discovered over the past year, doesn't have a straightforward relationship to public interest, and the public's interests are not always directly linked, are they?
Let's go back then. This is question number three from Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister says we should concentrate on what he's asking the country to do. We're asking the country to follow the rules. Yep. Now, the Prime Minister doesn't deny there was a Downing Street Christmas party last year. He's not denied it. He says no rules were broken. Both of those things can't be true, Prime Minister. He's taking the British public for fools. And as for following the rules, Prime Minister, it might be good just to look behind you when it comes to the question of masks. As ever, one rule for them, another rule for everybody else. Mr. Speaker, at the last election, the Prime Minister promised to build 40 new hospitals. 40 new hospitals. Page 10 of his manifesto. With waiting lists so high, Prime Minister, it's a very, very important commitment. Now, the Cabinet Office and the Treasury have checked on progress, and it's reported that they've reached a damning conclusion. I know the Chancellor would have seen that. They've concluded that the project needs a red flag because it's unachievable. Uh-huh. Prime Minister, is that true?
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker. We're getting on with... He plays politics and asks frivolous questions, Mr. Speaker. We're getting on with delivering on the people's priorities. And we're putting record investments into the NHS on top of the £34 billion with which we began, and then the £97 billion that we put in to fight COVID. We, Mr. Speaker, are helping to build another 40 new hospitals with an injection of £36 billion of investment, Mr. Speaker. Which that party voted against.
Just on the subject of the thing I want to pick up on there for listeners who aren't watching along, Patrick, is that it appeared to be a moment where Keir Starmer looked up at the front bench, thinking he could point out that there were no masks on the government front bench, and was slightly startled to see that absolutely everyone on the government front bench, I'm just looking now whether it's... Priti Patel's got a mask on.
I'm sure Alistair Jack's butler has ironed his, especially. He doesn't usually wear one.
Rishi Sunak's mask is so big, it almost covers his eyes. Yeah. So I think there are a few on the Tory backbenches who aren't, but I think that's slightly wrong-footed Keir Starmer, who also, Keir Starmer looks like he's had a very smart new haircut as well, which is also worth pointing out, because we normally talk about the Prime Minister's hair. We've gone from Christmas parties to building hospitals, and then Boris Johnson's response is, he plays politics and asks frivolous questions. I mean, that's PMQs, isn't it?
Yes, it is, a bit like fishermen complaining about the sea or whatever the idiom is. But I think, you know, as you mentioned your focus groups earlier, I think the Prime Minister is onto something there, right, in posing Keir Starmer as a fence-sitting carper who hurls from the ditch and he is all about delivery. But obviously the innate danger of that is that this is a government that increasingly looks incapable of delivering anything that it has promised to deliver. So again, I'm not quite sure about the whatever peroration Keir Starmer is going to tie these disparate themes together with, or indeed if he does. But I suspect it might end up in that sort of place.
Well, here we go. This is Matt Shawley on Times Radio, bringing you PMQs Unpacked, where he pulls the action live from the House of Commons to explain what's going on. Still joined by Patrick McGuire, the editor at the Times Red Box, to provide his ball-by-ball analysis. Let's go back. This is question number 4 from Keir Starmer.
Well, this is strange, Mr. Speaker, because the government hasn't been denying the reports about the red flag, and they haven't done since, but now the Prime Minister does. There's obviously some confusion on these benches over whether the Cabinet Office and the Treasury think he's on course to break yet another promise, this time on new building of hospitals. So he can clear this up this afternoon. If he's so confident in his answer, why doesn't he publish the progress report in full and let us all see it?
Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, what we're doing is not only building 40 new hospitals, but we are also, and it's incredible that we've been able to keep going throughout the pandemic, Mr. Speaker, but we're also making record investments in our NHS. Yes, it is, and we're also making record investments in our NHS. We have more doctors, more nurses working in our NHS than at any time in the history of that magnificent organisation. And rather than running down what they're trying to do, Mr. Speaker, and casting doubt on their efforts, he should get behind them, and he should particularly support our booster campaign.
I think that's what Boris Johnson would call a minestrone, from which we need to try and extract a crouton.
A crouton or two, yeah, God. We might struggle.
Trying to work out why Keir Starmer has decided to go on an internal, progress report on the building of hospitals, is this a sign of Wes Streeting's influence as the new Shadow Health Secretary? Do you think that being this focus on the 40 hospitals that could be, you know, where he's setting his priorities?
Well, I think Wes Streeting is a man of talent and vision. I'd actually say this, you know, you can trace this back to the, reshuffle in Keir Starmer's inner office a few months ago. And having had conversations with a lot of those people about how they're changing their approach, right, from sort of a scattergun of policies nobody remembers. You know, there was a Keir Starmer's Great Reset speech in the early months of this year, he was talking about green recovery bonds, right? Now, it is the opposition's prerogative to point to something the government has promised, i.e., and this pledge, the 40 hospitals pledge, is something you can fit on a bumper sticker to sort of mix my, to go all transatlantic on you, Matt. And it's pointing to something the government said, saying, these guys haven't delivered it. Why haven't they delivered it? And this is the bit that isn't quite working at the moment, I think. And that might be down to Keir Starmer's rhetorical abilities / limitations as a communicator. Why haven't these guys done the thing they said they were going to do to you when you voted under considerable personal anguish for the Conservatives for the first time, Jeff in Bishop Auckland? It's because while you were, watching Tiger King on your daughter's Netflix for the fifth time, they were having a party when you couldn't go down the pub. You know what I mean? But I don't think we're quite getting that broad sweep of the argument yet.
It's a really interesting thing that, and I suppose, and the thing that comes up in our focus groups all the time is the benefit of the government still seem to get a lot of benefit of the doubt. There's a bit less of it in our group this week, but over previous months, there's definitely some of that sort of residual there. And I suppose there's also a thing about how long it takes to build. I suspect on building new hospitals, you get a bit more benefit of the doubt than you do on some of the more immediate things that the government might have issued pledges on. But you're right. Sometimes there's something about the cream on the cake or the cherry on the top of the cake. Keir Starmer lacks that last little bit of sort of political stardust.
He lacks sort of what somebody put it to me. A former aide to Tony Blair put it to me like this when I was discussing with them over email a while ago a recent Starmer appearance in the Commons. And they just put it really succinctly. They said he doesn't have a fourth gear. You know, he can trundle through the first three gears really, really ably. But when you want to put pedal to the metal, he just can't do it. There's a sort of, you know, and you know, this sounds like an ad hominem, but you can almost hear it in his voice, can't you? You know, it goes up an octave and it sounds Paul Heaton from the House Martins without the tunefulness. And it just doesn't really work. He just doesn't have it, if you know what I mean.
I assume, I won't ask you to name your sources, but I assume that former Blair advisor, it was not Matthew Doyle, who is now Keir Starmer's director of communications.
No.
Right, let's go back to the comments there. Let's see if he can get into fourth gear. This is question number five from Keir Starmer.
Well, Mr. Speaker, there we have it. Prime Minister, I deny my hospital building programme has been flagged red as unachievable, but I don't have the confidence to publish the report. Mr. Speaker, the more we look at this promise, the murkier it gets. I've got a document here sent by the Department of Health to the NHS. It's called the New Hospital Programme Communications Playbook. I kid you not. It offers advice, Mr. Speaker, to make it easier to talk about the programme. Now, you might think that everyone knows what a new hospital is. I certainly thought I knew what a new hospital is before I read this document. But this guide instructs everybody to describe refurbishments and alterations on existing hospitals as new hospitals. We can all agree that refurbishments are a very good thing, but they're not new hospitals. So, Prime Minister, how many of the 40 are fix-up jobs on existing hospitals, and how many are actually the new hospitals he promised?
Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker, you obviously don't always go around building on greenfield sites. What we are doing is massive... You rebuild hospitals, and that is what we have said for the last 2.5 years, Mr. Speaker. It is the biggest programme of hospital building this country has ever undertaken. It's been made possible by this people's government, and it's in addition to what we're doing with the community diagnostics hubs, Mr. Speaker, and it's in addition to what we're doing in investing in our NHS. And I said it once, but I'll say it again. They had the opportunity to vote for that $36 billion. They turned it down, Mr. Speaker. We're getting on with the people's priorities. They're playing politics.
We should point out that it's always quite exciting when the Leader of the Opposition says, I have here a document. You think, is this going to be an explosive new bombshell revelation? I've just looked up, so we definitely talked about this on the show when it came out. This was a communications playbook obtained by the Health Service Journal at the end of August. So it has been knocking about for a while. But yeah, this is the thing which basically says you could call major refurbishments or even just a new wing of an existing hospital, you could call a new hospital. But it still strikes me as a slightly interesting topic for Keir Starmer to go on.
It is. And it's a gamble for Keir Starmer. He's gambling on the Prime Minister's gamble not paying off. It's the fundamental gamble of Boris Johnson's premiership, at least the first parliament, his first full parliament. Rachel Wolfe, who was one of the people who wrote his manifesto, wrote a good piece, I think, for Conservative Home a couple of months ago on this theme, which is what does and the question she sought to answer was, what does Boris Johnson need to deliver in terms of levelling up by 2024 or indeed 2023 for voters to say, yeah, things are changing? And the answer is basically hanging baskets. So she said, you know, if there are hanging baskets on your high street that weren't there before, things look cleaner, there are visible signs of dynamism in the local economy, things are being built that weren't there before, refurbishments are happening to shops that were boarded up and now full of life, right? That will be enough. That's the government's calculation. That will be enough. Spades in the ground will be enough for voters to say, look, Boris is delivering on what he promised. We're coming out of a pandemic and now he's getting to work. Ditto these new hospitals, right? In inverted commas. It's a bit like when we say, oh, is the Prime Minister lying about these new hospitals? Will a voter presented with a cancer ward, a children's ward, a refurbished Victorian infirmary, or a shiny new plate glass extension to their local hospital, providing services that weren't there before, will they say, well, hang on, you know, we didn't have those services there before. That is, you know, my experience of the hospital is different to how it was before. Will they be necessarily quibble that, you know, as Boris Johnson said, greenfields haven't been concreted over to build an entirely new hospital in the space of 3 years? It's a question worth asking. And I think, you know, Labour are perfectly entitled to push ahead at that, particularly given how totemic the issue of local hospitals are, particularly for the sorts of small towns. You know, every Tory MP, indeed the Tory candidate in North Shropshire, is talking about A&E services or shuttered hospitals. But I don't know. The hanging baskets theory of re-election is one I find quite compelling. And
the other thing about the 40 hospitals is nobody is expecting 40 hospitals for them. It's a national thing. It's a good sort of national battleground question. But I'm not going to get 40 new hospitals near me. So you're right. If my hospital has a spruce up or has a new wing, you know, the hospital will be better than it was before. So, yeah, it's interesting
exactly
how that...
I think the example we should hold close to our hearts, if you'll let me go into a niche for 30 seconds, is the example of Dr. Richard Taylor, right? Labour MPs constantly bang on about who were there, constantly bang on about the improvements to the NHS between 1997 and 2010, waiting list slash whatever, whatever. But in 2001, a doctor called Richard Taylor won election in Wyre Forest as an independent because they'd shut down Kidderminster, or threatened to shut down Kidderminster Hospital, against the backdrop of a massive Labour landslide, right? That is the theory we need to, you know, it's not the 40 new hospitals, it's the hospital in the marginal constituency that matters electorally.
We always like a 30-second niche. Thank you for that, Patrick McGrath. Let's go back. We've got the last question now. Question number 6 from Keir Starmer.
No wonder so many Tory donors paid so much for that wallpaper last year. It probably told me it's building a new flat. It's the same old story from this Prime Minister, week in, week out, defending the indefensible and broken promises. His mates were found to be corrupt. He tried to get them off the hook. Downing Street throws parties during lockdown. He says, not a problem. He promised there'd be no tax rises. Then he put up tax. He promised to be a rail revolution in the north. Then he cancelled the trains. He promised no one would have to sell their home for care. Then along came his working class dementia tax. He promised 40 new hospitals. And even if you count the paint jobs, his own watchdog says he can't deliver it. Isn't this the truth, Mr. Speaker, that any promises from this Prime Minister aren't worth the manifesto paper they're written on?
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman dribbles on irrelevantly about wallpaper and parties, playing politics. And by the way, on that, I'm told that when the Deputy Leader and Shadow Secretary of State for the Future of Work was told that she wasn't invited, she denounced it. She denounced it as idiotic, childish, and pathetic. Mr. Speaker, they're getting on with factional infighting. We are delivering for the people of this country. Today, cutting tax for the lowest paid people in this country. One, as a result of our universal credit changes, 1.9 million families getting £1,000 more in their pay packets this year. The biggest programme of rail infrastructure this century, Mr Speaker. Three new high-speed lines, and we're fixing social care. They have no plan whatever, Mr Speaker. And don't forget, Their resort to absolutely every problem is either to take this country back into lockdown or to open up to uncontrolled immigration, Mr Speaker. That is their approach. We are delivering on the people's priorities, and we have more people in work now as a result of the balanced and proportionate approach that we are taking than we had before the pandemic began. And if we listened to him, Mr Speaker, if we listened to Captain Hindsight, we'd all still be in lockdown. And that is the truth.
Well, it's a bit of a greatest hits on both of them there, Patrick McGuire. There's part of me that thinks it's quite good when Keir Starmer tries to pull together lots of threads. The risk is that every PMQs ends up being the same. So he goes through, you know, corrupt friends, breaking lockdown rules, putting up taxes, broken promises on rail, broken promises on care, broken promises on hospital. It's sort of a good pair, but we could get that every week. There's not a, you know, and as a result, Boris Johnson can come back with all of his usual Captain Hindsight. We'd still be the European Health Medicines Agency. We'd all still be in lockdown. It's a bit one note. There's not a huge element of surprise from Keir Starmer.
Well, not for, you know, saddos like you and I, Matt, who tune into this every week. But I suppose what Labour have lacked under Keir Starmer is a sense of mission. The sort of mission you can put on a mug or a bumper sticker or, for the Blairites listening, on a pledge card. And, you know, even if this peroration is one note and we get it every week, that's what Labour has lacked. A dinky
and as for following the rules, Prime Minister.
Message about the government and its failure to follow the rules, or whatever. So I think, you know, all good political communications, as Linton Crosby or Alistair Campbell can tell you, is to a certain extent one note. So this is probably, as much as we will, you know, bore ourselves to death analysing this for the next 3 years, if Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson last that long, it's probably a sign of the discipline. The newfound discipline in the Labour ranks.
That's all we've got time for on today's episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. And you can listen via the Times Radio app. Catch me Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, live on Times Radio. And if you want to come on and play the hugely popular quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? Email me your details, matt.chorley@times.radio. And we'll get you on very soon.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.